I've said many times that Mars is the worst. It is dry, airless, has intense radiation, low gravity. It doesn't have a lot going for it. But theoretically, we could make Mars better. We could terraform this planet. And this has been a dream that has been around for decades. But the actual plans, the science that you would use to carry this off have always seemed daunting. But new technologies have come out in the last couple of years, new ideas that could make terraforming Mars more of a reality. Still a multi-generational, perhaps several thousand year endeavor, but still a thing that we could begin and see serious progress even within our lifetimes. My guest today is Dr. Erica DeBenedictis. She is the CEO of Pioneer Labs, which is supported by the Astera Institute's residency program. Dr. Erica and her collaborators wrote a recent piece in Nature Astronomy about how there's a lot of interesting new technology that has come out that could be used to terraform Mars, and that we should consider how we could start running some of these experiments on Mars relatively soon. Of course, there are ethical issues with performing these kinds of experiments on Mars, but it really looks like that if we agree as a species that a thing that we want to do is make Mars a habitable world, this is a thing that we could do. All right, enjoy this conversation with Dr. Erica DeBenedictis. Erica, why does Mars suck? How? Yeah, why is it so bad?
Yeah, truly, Mars is the worst. It's, Well, it captures the imagination because it sort of has all the right raw materials, but they're at completely the wrong temperature and pressure. So if you go outside on Mars, you are dead five different ways in like 5 seconds. But it doesn't have to be that way, and that's why it's intriguing. It has all the raw materials. They're just not in the right chemical form, but they could be rearranged, right? And that's what's cool about it.
And the potential is there. I mean, Mars is in the habitable zone. And, you know, since we finally got good measurements of the surface of Mars, researchers have been trying to figure out how do we fix it. And I can remember like Carl Sagan offering ideas and advice on how we might be able to fix Mars. He also proposed ways to fix Venus, which I don't think are going to pan out. But his Mars ideas, you know, so, you know, I guess, you know, what was in the olden days, how did they think that they could terraform Mars?
Yeah. So, I mean, this idea has been around for a long time, as you say. You know, 30 years ago, it was science fiction. we didn't know enough about Mars to know if it was possible. We didn't have any of the technology we have today. People thought that, you know, Mars is cold right now. It has a northern ice cap where there's a lot of both CO2 and water that's frozen as ice. And, you know, one of the sort of former ideas, which has since been disproven, was this idea that if only you just melted the ice cap, maybe that would release enough, it would liberate enough gas to form an atmosphere. And atmosphere means a nice little blanket. Like, we on Earth have actually too much of a nice little CO2 blanket, so that's why we're warm and toasty. Perhaps you could make the same for Mars by taking its dry ice and turning it into a CO2 blanket. We now know that there's nowhere near enough material in the ice cap, so that's not going to work. So you absolutely, if you're going to get atmosphere, you have to get it from somewhere else. People also used to think that maybe you might need to restart the magnetic field to turn Mars into something that's habitable by humans or maybe by anything. We now also don't really think that's true. Mars, you know, because it has a thin atmosphere now, and also because it doesn't have a magnetic field, it has more surface radiation. So we have this magnetic shield, essentially. That means we still have, you know, UV, you still have to wear sunscreen, but we're shielded from some of the worst radiation. Also, having a magnetic field means you lose atmosphere to space more slowly because solar wind sort of blows it away, essentially. So on geologic timescales, Mars will continue to sort of leak atmosphere into space, but it's so slow, you could top it up with, you know, 10 starships a year to just keep the pressure up if that's a thing you really care about. And the surface radiation is such that it seems likely that if you have at least some atmosphere, it partially, at least partially protects against it. Radiation will still be higher. You still need better sunscreen, but it doesn't seem like the deal breaker that it used to be. And proposals for how to create a magnetic field are bonkers even on terraforming scale.
yeah. Like, you know, crash, I don't know, Ganymede into Mars, and then you will liquefy the planet, and then you will restart the magnetic field.
Yeah, this is another really common thing. Oh, let's just crash asteroids into Mars to create, you know, add water. Let's crash ice asteroids into Mars, add nitrogen, and so on. I think, again, that has been popularized by Terraforming Mars, the board game. Honestly, a great resource for sort of some of this, like, it's a wonderful actually index of sort of all of these ideas that people have proposed for how one might do climate engineering on that scale, like on another planet. But yeah, less feasible and way more expensive and much slower than I think new technologies that people are thinking about now that are just much simpler.
I mean, because then you end up with a world that's uninhabitable for thousands of years because it's now molten lava on the surface.
Yeah, right? Some of these interventions have other issues. So, I mean, Elon Musk has famously tweeted about how he wants to nuke the Northern Pole. Again, this references this now proven incorrect idea that if you just liberated the gas on the Northern ice cap, it would be sufficient, which it's not. And then on top of that, please don't use nukes. Like, first off, it's against the Outer Space Treaty. And second off, yeah, then you have this secondary, like, fallout and radiation and stuff. There are other better ways to, like, heat things.
Were there any other sort of bad ideas or not fully thought through ideas before we can move on to what sort of the current scientific thinking is?
I think another thing that has sort of just now been superseded by, we'll get to some of this new stuff, was the hypothesis that, okay, maybe the Northern ice cap isn't sufficient to make an atmosphere that's high enough pressure to make it warm. So maybe you need something more powerful than CO2, right? CO2 is a greenhouse gas, but there are more powerful gases like chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, which we fret about a lot, right? Like they're a real problem on Earth, even though they're not very plentiful. And that's because they're so efficient at trapping heat per molecule. So folks thought that, in fact, there was a very nice paper that showed that you, in principle, could use a custom mixture of chlorofluorocarbons to trap enough heat to keep Mars warm. The only trouble was it was truly an enormous amount of CFCs, and no one could figure out, I mean, like, how would you even produce them, right? So again, it was like in the right direction of like, what are other ways that we could make like a temperature efficient atmosphere that maybe are not identical to Earth? Maybe we're not entirely duplicating Earth. Maybe that's not quite what the end point of terraforming is, but rather you create something new that works for that planet that is still habitable.
Yeah. And I think that people don't realize that once you get the atmosphere there, it will actually last for a long time. You say 10 starships a year. I know that, like, if you can get above like 1 km/s in escape velocity, then it can hold on to its atmosphere. And in fact, the moon could hold on to an atmosphere and be a very similar situation, that you would have to deliver the occasional starship filled with atmosphere. And yet, you know, once you got it up to pressure, you could walk around on the surface of the moon and breathe. Although it would be weird with the long day and night, you know, you'd have to probably change the rotation speed. Like, there's a bunch of things you'd have to do.
Yeah, well, we should talk more about the moon and also Venus. But yeah, I think what's funny, it's like the solar system we see now is the solar system at, like, it's not quite at equilibrium, but it's like a solar system that is in this dynamic equilibria at like geologic timescales. So we are not seeing planets that have like, there are some planets that are like super geologically active or something. So maybe there's some exceptions, but for a lot of the like rocky planets, we're seeing things that have been experiencing the same sort of chemical processes and, you know, solar wind blowing atmosphere away for like billions of years. And yes, these planets lose atmosphere, but they do so on timescales that are like so much longer than like human civilization that it's like you know, it's worth recognizing that these effects occur, but they, like, the humans that would need to deal with their consequences will be, like, way more technologically advanced than us. And so maybe we don't have to be the ones to solve things that happen on, like, 100 million year timescales, right?
Yeah, yeah. There's, like, this other problem, like, that the sun is heating up and will eventually cook the Earth. Well, it turns out if you just bring an asteroid past the Earth every, oh, I don't know, few thousand years, tens of thousands of years, once, that's enough of an outward shift of the Earth on a regular basis that you can keep a pace of the sun heating up. So, you know, there are all of these things, as you say, I think it's a great way to think about it, that it took us 4.5 billion years to get into this place. We don't have to fix it overnight. Okay, so those are some of the ideas that maybe aren't going to work as well as we hope or are catastrophic and would require a very long recovery time. But now we can be a little more surgical about this. So new technologies have come about that you think can make this a little more straightforward.
Yeah, so I'd maybe highlight three technologies that together make it seem awfully feasible, actually, for us to have like green Mars in my lifetime, like plants growing on their own outside. Humans would still not quite be able to breathe yet.
Lichen.
It could be lichen, yeah. Green stuff outside, right? And those three technologies are Starship, new methods for warming Mars with new types of heat reflective glitter, and then synthetic biology, the fact that we actually know how to create organisms or breed organisms that have some of these unusual properties. Again, Mars is never going to be an exact duplicate of Earth. It can just be closer, right? So maybe going through those in order. So, I mean, Starship is such a huge deal. I feel like people, like space missions previously were so mass constrained, and Starship is increasing Earth's launch capacity per dollar by like 100-fold, like multiple orders of magnitude, which is wild. like from the cost perspective, it just really upends, I think, a lot of the things that used to be constraints on what missions we even thought were possible.
Right. Now, viewers from the future have got to keep in mind that we're recording this episode in spring 2025, where what Starships do is explode. and sometimes crash land and occasionally work, but they have yet to
work, yeah.
This has not been demonstrated yet to actually function. It is, you know, in concept going to work, but that whole tech stack has yet to be proven to be successful. But I think even with its current iteration, you know, as long as you don't have to reuse the thing, you can fire it off to Mars. It's already it's the ability to launch enormous payloads into space. And even if Starship doesn't do the trick, Blue Origin is hot on its heels. A bunch of Chinese companies are doing the same thing. Even Rocket Lab is working on reusable rockets. So I think we're definitely entering a new regime of heavy lift vehicles.
Totally. And the fact that there's now multiple competitors, further, as you say, like, again, folks have not quite aced it yet. But yeah. There's multiple shots on goal, and it does seem like it's a matter of time, not a fully question of, like, is this even possible? And I'd say for Mars, I mean, SpaceX is talking up a big game about a 2028 launch window Mars lander with Starship, the first. They have not yet demonstrated in-orbit refueling, which they need to do. I think one day they'll manage. Maybe it'll explode a couple times before then. But, you know, it's not an impossible problem. I think it's more likely it'll be like the 2031 launch window at least. But this is starting to get, these are numbers that are soon, right? So I mean, I think it's coming, and plus with the multiple competitors, it's like these things are becoming real in a way that's very cool. And all that is to say, it just means that it is no longer totally off the table. It's no longer totally crazy to think about manipulating Mars's climate using large-scale mass that has to be transferred from Earth. And that's something that didn't used to be really on the table, actually. It used to be like, but how would you do that? Even if you had a technology where moving mass would help how would you move the mass?
We can just barely, you know, we can just barely get a 1-ton rover onto the surface of Mars. How could we get 100 tons down to the surface of Mars at a reasonable price?
Well, exactly.
Now there is a pathway that could get us there.
Now we could get there. And so this brings us to the second technology. So my collaborator, Edwin Kite, at University of Chicago. Now he's also a resident at the Astera Institute, which I'm also at. He was thinking about this paper that I was telling you about, the chlorofluorocarbons for heating Mars. So is there something better than CO2? This planet is so cold, it's so low pressure, that if you poured liquid water on the surface, it would either freeze or evaporate immediately. Like, you just can't have liquid water. No liquid water, no life. So you got to make it warmer or higher pressure, ideally both. And so he was thinking about ways. Heating is sort of the easier of the two to imagine. And so he came up with a proposal for how to use little metallic rods that basically reflect IR radiation that would be so much more efficient than chlorofluorocarbons. So the idea is you could bulk manufacture these probably on Earth. Again, until we figure out how to do it on Mars, that's where the sort of tech dev comes in, and ship them to Mars. And they are so efficient per mass that it starts looking like you could heat Mars at a rate of like, 10 billion dollars per year per degree Celsius warmed. And that's it starts being like actual degrees Celsius within Earth's anticipated launch capacity. So it starts getting into the territory where you could actually heat Mars up like 30 degrees Celsius, like within our lifetime.
And I remember that paper. We reported on that at Universe Today. And it was like, these were microscopic, like, these were nanoparticles, but they were sort of a perfect shape that you would release them into the atmosphere and then they would float around and warm the atmosphere.
Yeah. And they, I think, unlike a CO2 atmosphere that would sort of be very permanent, except on maybe super geologic timescales, the nanorods have actually the blessing and the curse that they will settle out eventually. So they will, and this is sort of some of the ongoing work of like doing math to figure out how long would they remain aloft if you were to release them. But they would eventually settle out, maybe on the order of like a couple years. And this is good, I guess, because if you're going to heat Mars, you may want it to be reversible in case you messed up or something comes up that you discover it's actually not a good idea. It's a con because it does mean you have to continue to supply them. And so maintaining Mars's warmth would require active work on humanity's part, possibly forever until we develop more technology. So pros and cons, but starting to be math-wise and cost-wise may be feasible, which is pretty cool.
And theoretically, you move to a factory on Mars where you're just spraying these into the air.
That would be ideal. It would require a fair amount of infrastructure because you have to be able to mine the metal and so on. It's also possible, again, these are, you know, low technology readiness level, but it's also possible you could perhaps manufacture these a little bit more efficiently with like a semi-biological process that can at least get you the shape and help them not clump, but you'd still need a factory, but it's maybe less of a complicated factory. So in theory, yes. And that would mean that, again, Mars would start being more self-sufficient, which is
why this threat, this rod-like shape, why is that advantageous?
That's a great question. You should ask Edwin. I think he's the physics guy. Yeah. He has a lot of intuition for that.
But easier to keep aloft is what I'm sort of imagining. Larger surface area to like for the wind. Okay, so that's one interesting technology that would give us a dramatic. And do they have a sense of just like how you say $10 billion per year to increase the temperature by 1 degree? So you do that for, and right now, you know, like a really nice day on Mars is 20 degrees, but the nighttime is minus 90, minus 100.
Yeah, the struggle is even worse than that, which is that the areas of Mars that you, if you were to heat up Mars, if you had a knob that was like average global temperature and you could turn it, The problem is you actually have to heat up the parts of Mars that are today pretty cold to reasonable temperatures, because that's where the water is. And going back to this thing we were previously talking about geologic timescales and processes that have been ongoing for a long time. So like the reason Mars only has ice water at places that are very cold is because places that are warmer, that ice water will sublimate more readily and then be lost to the atmosphere and then get blown away out of the atmosphere. And so this is like why we actually have to heat Mars up quite a fair amount so that the places that are currently very cold are the ones that melt.
Mm. Okay. All right. So that's one piece of technology that's kind of exciting and could work.
Yeah. So with an approach like that, and I'd say there are other proposals aside from the nanorods for doing sort of abiotic climate engineering on Mars.
Yeah, you mentioned in your paper mirrors, silica, aerogel, like there's a lot of this technology that's being proposed.
Yeah, there's a bunch of concepts for this. I mean, you know, on Earth, we're also working on like, you know, climate engineering here as well. And many of the same technologies would, you know, in reverse be sort of the idea on Mars. So yeah, whichever way wins, you heat Mars up a fair amount to the point where you get liquid water on the surface. And this is where like the third of these big advances come in. So 30 years ago, we didn't have synthetic biology. We didn't really know how to do, we didn't know a ton about DNA or how to engineer it or that it was possible to engineer it. And now we do. So that's most of my background. I started off in space science and went all the way to experimental biology. And now I'm kind of putting those two back together and trying to create microbes that would grow on Mars if you made Mars mud. So if you melted the ice and it mixed with regolith and you ended up with mud. And what's cool and difficult about Mars is that the dirt has both nutrients. So Mars dirt actually has a fair amount of nitrogen in it. It's like pre-fertilized by Earth standards. Usually here we have to add nitrogen. That's what fertilizer is. But it also has a bunch of toxins. So it has perchlorate, which is basically bleach. You probably have it in your house specifically to kill microbes. And it has a bunch of salt. It has a bunch of heavy metal oxides that, you know, are most organisms would not tolerate. So we have to identify organisms on Earth that are sort of on the fringes of living already in extreme environments, mix and match their properties with genetic engineering and create things that would actually thrive in that setting.
Now, there are experiments on the International Space Station where they are testing different kinds of extremophiles and have found some pretty surprising capabilities, cyanobacteria, various kinds of lichens, mosses, even tardigrades can go into hibernation in Mars conditions, waiting for things to warm up or for the water to return. So, I mean, do we have any extreme microbes that if you had that Mars mud that they could get to work immediately, or would you still need to genetically modify them?
We've genetically modified them, and now yes.
Oh, okay, right.
Yeah.
After you were done.
Yeah, we have some first examples of organisms that can grow on Mars dirt plus water, which is super cool. I'd say though, something you said is really interesting. So there's a whole field of astrobiology, which is like the study of like, could life exist somewhere and what would it be like, right? And one of the things that drives me slightly nuts actually about this field is that I think people tend to confuse actually organisms that are thriving, like growing, dividing rapidly, making biomass. They confuse those with organisms that have gone into stasis to protect themselves for better conditions later, right? And we have a lot of examples of organisms that can go into stasis in Mars-like conditions and then later recover when put into more mild conditions. And we cannot terraform with those organisms, right? We need things that actually grow fast in quite extreme conditions. and ideally not go into stasis, because that will not help us. So and that's this, that this is sort of an interesting transition that's happening, which is like astrobiology thinks a lot about, well, could there be things sporulated in the dirt on Mars? And instead, if you have your terraforming hat on, you're like, okay, how do I make things that won't sporulate? Because this is the environment they get. This is when they need to grow, right? So it's like a little tweak of like, it's more of an engineering discipline.
And so you excitedly said yes, post genetic engineering. So let's talk about some of these life forms.
So I run this nonprofit research organization called Pioneer Labs. So we're trying to make pioneer organisms. So in ecology, when you have a, you know, natural disaster, a volcano or something like that, the pioneer species are the ones that are first to repopulate an area, first to create, you know, break rock down into dirt that other less extreme organisms could actually grow in. And so that's what we have to do here. We have to take this really crazy environment and turn it into something that's a little softened, has more organic matter in the soil, maybe has nitrogen fixing bacteria in the soil.
Not as much bleach.
Exactly. So right. One of the big categories of extreme organisms that folks think about are perchlorate reducing microbes. So perchlorate is the bleach like substance that's in Mars dirt. It comes actually from the fact that Mars has so much surface radiation, it like produces perchlorate in the dirt at a rate. So over, again, geologic timescales, it accumulates. And there are actually, it's also present on Earth, but it's much rarer. So there are places people have gone and they've found very unusual bacteria that can actually eat perchlorate, use it as an energy source. And that creates an opportunity to create bacteria that actually thrive in Mars dirt rather than are killed by it.
Right, right. And so you've got these existing organisms. And so would you be looking to put together that capability with some other capability, or would you use different species one after the other? Start with the perchlorate reducers and then try to populate it with the next species. Succession.
Yeah, exactly. No, that is eventually the idea. Well, I mean, right now what we have is we have a handful of organisms that grow very badly in Mars dirt plus water. Right now what we're doing is we're trying to both test a wider variety of organisms, see if we can find a better starting point, and also do genetic engineering and also just directed evolution to make the ones we've already found better, right? Now, there's a separation of timescales here. So we're mostly talking about terraforming. For terraforming, you probably want things that are perchlorate reducing. You want probably different species that fix nitrogen, and then you want succession by increasingly complex multicellular plants, right? So there's like a whole pathway to like building an ecosystem from the ground up. Like way before you get there, we're also just thinking sort of practically. Again, maybe SpaceX is going to have a 2031 Mars lander. And if so, we want to have an experiment on it to check to see if, in fact, the things that we think grow in the dirt with real dirt, right? Not the dirt that we've developed a recipe for by scrutinizing rover data, but like real dirt, right?
Scoop up some regolith, mix it with water, try these microbes, see how they do.
See if we're right. And ideally produce something useful while you're at it. So folks at NASA are really interested in biomanufacturing as like a in-situ resource utilization technology. So that's the thought, which is that we can, as a very preliminary step, we can test the first microbes on Mars. And at the same time as checking that they actually grow, we can produce something useful, like, for example, bioplastic that can be used to make, you know, greenhouses. So things that are actually useful raw materials that can be produced as a result of the microbes even before you get to building like a whole ecosystem, right?
That seems like a big ask on the poor microbes, though. Like, not only do you have to survive, but you're also in a farm.
Yeah, some of them are good at it. So what's interesting, though, the bioplastics, some... this is actually what's elegant about bioplastic. So some organisms, they actually, how do I put this? Bioplastic, it's sort of like how when I eat too many croissants, like I get fat. Like what they're doing is they're storing carbohydrates like in their body. And what's cool is they actually do it when presented with extreme conditions, and it helps them survive extreme conditions. So it's an interesting example of a trait that's good for us humans because it's a product we want, but it's also good for the microbe that's making it. It sort of jives with like its life cycle and its sort of living incentives, right?
Yeah. Again, like we've done a lot of sort of, people thinking about different kinds of bioreactors that you could put on the surface of Mars to generate building materials, you know, even repair existing building materials with these kinds of solutions. But it sort of feels like you'll have to be like, once you've demonstrated that this is feasible and that it looks like it's going to work, then you're going to want to deploy this into places and have them start to try and grow and go through their own evolutionary cycles. And they hopefully will figure out the details on their own through evolution.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And this is the thing that I'm excited about, which is like, we in the lab, we can and will do everything we can to like prep organisms ahead of time that have the best chance at having the best properties and growing well. But yeah, like this is what's cool about biology. It will self-evolve. So if we can just actually set up organisms that are actually growing in Mars dirt, they will, on some time scale, themselves get better because they are just evolving. And so planetary scale evolution, that's what generated our entire biosphere. Like, what does that look like for Mars? Anyway, that's the thing I'm excited about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So give us a sense of then, like, the time scale. So imagine someone has said, okay, Erica, go for it. You got all the money you need, as many starships as required. We want Mars terraformed and we want it now.
Yeah.
Begin. What's your plan?
I'd say all of this, part of why we're talking is because I and Edwin Kite and a bunch of other collaborators, we recently wrote this perspective piece that got published in Nature Astronomy that basically says, hey, it's actually crazy we're not studying terraforming more seriously. Like, it is actually pretty feasible at this point, especially relative to all these other crazy things we study, like making humans live forever. And we should take this seriously. And there need to be a lot more people thinking about this, because what I just described to you is the best we've got after a tiny community thinks about it for not that long. So I would really hope that with more brain power, we could do much better.
Well, I was just saying, like, give me a sense of just like the timelines. Like,
yeah.
You know, you've got as many starships as required. You've got as much, you know, carbon nanotubes as you need, or iron rods. Begin.
Yep. Yeah.
What happens?
So 2028, first flight test, does a small scale actual demonstration of the warming with nanorods or other, and also the first actual test microbe meets Mars dirt that they grow. That is followed by, you do two things in parallel, right? So on one track, you are doing local warming with your preferred technique. And on the other track, you have ongoing like evolution on Mars to adapt microbes for like actually in situ, like in the real conditions. And you start building out the ecosystems in specifically in the locally warmed areas that you have created. And, you know, the process takes that there's like some bootstrapping to do, right? So you can only heat Mars so fast. So you likely have to do things like make greenhouses that are like partially the outdoors is warmer, but partially it's also just pressurized and enclosed to create liquid water. And in like 30 or 40 years, these two processes meet in the middle, and you can actually get your organisms that were once needed a greenhouse to actually grow on their own outside. And that's when you start getting to exciting territory where, like, when you look at this, when you look at Mars in the sky, it's literally red. And like, you could actually get to the point in our lifetimes where it like starts looking a different color, right? Because you actually have planetary scale self, like bacteria are self-replicating chemistry robots. Like that's the technology we have. That's a technology on Earth that is what caused this planet to be habitable. So before photosynthetic microbes arrived, there wasn't oxygen in the atmosphere. And it was microbes that breathed oxygen into the atmosphere, and photosynthesis splits water into oxygen and it stores its hydrogen as sugar. So in about 30 or 40 years, you get a Mars that starts visibly looking different, and it has a planetary-wide a biosphere that is beginning to breathe an oxygen atmosphere onto the planet that, you know, on a longer time scale, humans could then enjoy outside.
So when do you think we would be able to take our first breath without a spacesuit on the surface of Mars?
Yeah, we've done some math on this. It seems like it would take a couple thousand years.
Okay.
And unfortunately, I don't know how to make photosynthesis go faster. But again, we should all think on it. I'd say also, even in the sort of green Mars in sort of 30, 40 years I describe, it would be at the point where if you dropped like a dome down over a vegetated area, that vegetation would breathe enough atmosphere just into the dome over a period of like 2-ish years. So you start getting to something that like on human timescales, you can generate atmosphere, not the entire column up to space, but up to the top of a dome that you might want to live in. So it starts, you know, it would still be semi inside. It's like para-terraforming for a while, but it starts either way being a big game changer in terms of how much technology or what technologies are necessary for like permanent human inhabitation.
So I think, you know, we should definitely talk about the ethical consequences of doing a thing like this. And you guys mentioned this in your paper that you're aware that proposing to turn Mars into a place like Earth would have consequences for any indigenous life that is already there. So how do you think about that?
Yeah, I think this is a really big discussion that's not even just about the life that might or might not be on Mars. It's also about like humanity's perception of our place in the solar system and like what is appropriate. So like on one hand, some people see, you know, greening Mars or having human presence on Mars, having net positive climate externalities as being like good stewards of like the natural resources we have, you know, in our neighborhood. Others see it as like intrusive, that like, you know, maybe humans should never go anywhere. Like we should never alter anything from our presence. And those are two conflicting views. I think people have really strong opinions, especially because of current Earth climate debates, right?
And humanity's historical poor treatment of indigenous populations, be they people or plants.
Depends. There's also a long history of humanity having positive influence on, you know, on maintaining climates or populations, right? It's not all bad. I think it's just because of current, you know, climate crises, I think we are like wise to be very acutely aware of instances where we have failed, right?
Well, I'm thinking about how as soon as we finish this conversation, I'm going to go grab my loppers and go and remove a whole bunch of Scottish broom from my Vancouver Island landscape because this invasive shrub has taken over the entire place. And if I don't go out there every year and cut it all off, then nothing native will grow, just this blanket of Scottish broom from horizon to horizon. And so, you know, that's, you know, someone thought it'd be great to plant a Scottish broom in his garden in Victoria 100 years ago. And now the entire west coast of North America is infested with this stuff and it is out competing everything else that we have. So I think, you know, the ethical issue that we have to face is that if we bring these chlorine-loving superbugs into this environment, if there is any indigenous life, we are going to give it a run for its money.
It's possible. I think there's another possibility that people don't think about, though, which is that as we've learned from a lot of the astrobiology research, a lot of the life we know of, if it does or did exist on Mars in the past, it's probably desiccated, so it's all dried out, or frozen. We have this issue on Earth where people take ice cores from glaciers and discover they thaw stuff out that like doesn't exist on the planet anymore, right? But it's been preserved. So I think there's another angle here, which is that like warming Mars, even if we did it totally abiotically, like we continue to not add new life, might be a very powerful way to discover endogenous life, right? That is currently frozen or desiccated. And this is, again, this is not the angle that we have been thinking about it, right? Like we have been thinking of like, let's send individual rovers to individual spots and kind of look around, not like a larger scale, just like different tactics for search for life.
I think it sort of depends on whether or not there is any endogenous life there at all. Like if it turns out it's just a rock and we explore it and we figure it, you know, we test out as much as we can and we never find anything, no evidence that life was ever there on Mars, which wouldn't be a surprising outcome, but that there just was never life on Mars, that, you know, it would almost be surprising that life got established twice on two different planets in the same solar system.
Yeah, totally. I think many people, not everyone, but many people do seem to believe that like a definitive answer on the presence or absence of endogenous life on Mars would be a thing they want to know prior to making any further action, whether it is like humans going to Mars, which will contaminate it or anything. I think we honestly are like getting kind of close to the point where we may need to have a discussion about what it means to prove there isn't life on Mars, which is impossible, right? You can never prove something doesn't exist. But it's like folks want to check subsurface water, maybe like check some the like very cold brines. So you can get like super, super salty water that's liquid, but at very low temperature. But it's like, I think largely the places to look for endogenous life on Mars are becoming fewer as we have done increasing amounts of diligence and continue having all data indicate there's nothing there. And again, it's impossible to prove something doesn't exist, but like that's the discussion we need to start having, which is like, well, the reason we're excited about terraforming Mars is because it has this potential, and that's why we're looking so hard. So how do we distinguish the place that's possible and ethical to terraform from the place that we're excited about continuing to search because there's something actually there, right? And that's the meat of the ethical dilemma today.
Yeah, and it is interesting, you know, when we think about how we can never get our spacecraft clean enough. We can never decontaminate them to remove all of our filthy, filthy Earth bacteria. And so we have already sent Earth bacteria to Mars. Totally. And then the concern is always, well, what if it spreads? What if it infests the local habitat? But at the same time, there is no habitat. And we're not finding, you know, if we don't find life, it's because it's just so terrible, so awful. And that the whatever biota is on that planet has just been put into the deep freeze and will remain there until the sun, you know, boils it.
Well, or we heat it, right? And then
well, yeah,
and then
we do something. Right.
And then we have another interesting dilemma, which is like, if you are to terraform Mars, the search for life just begins again, right?
Yeah.
It begins with new techniques. There was an interesting perspective piece that came out recently. This was something I think Pete Warden wrote about the fact that if we were to try to terraform Mars and found life there, it's not clear whether the life we'd introduce would be better than the life that's already there. It's better adapted for possibly millions of years, right? So perhaps it's more likely to imagine we would go there. If we did find life, maybe it would be better. We would learn to work with it rather than with things we brought with us. And again, this is all super theoretical and there's no like, and this is what's frustrating. It's like everyone, like it'd be so cool if there was life on Mars, but there's also like increasingly seems like there are slim chances of finding it. at least endogenous life. And so, yeah, what do you do in that situation?
Yeah. Yeah. And yet, I mean, the most, like, if it did turn out that it was locally sourced life there and that it did evolve separately from Earth, that is fascinating because totally. You have a second data point on how life could have evolved from abiogenesis. But even if it is related to us through some form of panspermia, then you've got a common ancestor, and then you can go, well, how did that work and how did it move? Like either way, you know, we probably want to err on the side of let's be very careful about searching for life on Mars before we turn the place into Earth 2.0.
Yeah. And I would say, like, these are not my views, but there are people who would argue that, like, there is urgency to terraform because, like, civilization X risk is decreased by, like, multiple planets, you know, Q existential risk from asteroids and all that stuff. So, I mean, I think that there are other ethical frameworks too that put the, you know, ask the question, but, like, is it appropriate to, like, protect hypothetical microbes at the expense of, you know, human civilization, right?
I would argue against that position all day long. Just that, you know, if you're talking about thousands of years where we can make Mars potentially breathable, like, we would have to do some severe damage to planet Earth to make it anywhere nearly as bad as Mars. So this is our best planet. And if, you know, if the existential risk that we face is AI, well, the robots love to go to space. They could gladly chase us to Mars. So we're not going to be able to run.
Yeah, the AI will be building the Dyson sphere around the sun very soon.
Yeah, exactly.
I live in San Francisco. I know all about this.
Yeah. What's your P-Doom? Question I always ask people, Erica, what are you obsessed with right now?
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe actually on the AI topic. So a thing I think about a lot is how there are lots of cool advances in AI, everything from LLMs to things like AlphaFold. So, you know, learned models that are specific to particular scientific processes. And I've been trying to think about how to use those toward the goal of creating microbes that are useful on Mars for human astronauts to make bioplastic, or the sort of longer term terraforming goal. And these advances are really cool. I mentioned I started off in, like, computational physics and astronomy, which is a discipline that was very attractive to me as, like, a young scientist, because, like, math works really well in space. Like, the solar system is a vacuum, and so you can do really cool, you can compute orbits to Mars with, like, Newtonian physics, and it's basically right. I went into biology when I sort of recognized how difficult it is for us to predict biological processes, how bad we were, especially at the time. This was, like, 10 years ago. We were so bad at predicting just how will one protein, one biomolecule, just be shaped when you put it in water. I mean, an incredibly simple question, so much simpler than a cell, and even that we struggled with. And now with AlphaFold, we can make good predictions about that. And I'm excited because I think some of these sort of AI as a computational paradigm seems to play nice with the underlying structure of problems in biology. And I'm excited for that approach to be more fully explored for more than just protein folding.
And I mean, I think most people are very familiar with AlphaFold and sort of solved what was thought to be an impossible problem in this one tiny aspect of biology. But, you know, I think that a lot of us are still waiting for our cancer cures to come thanks to AlphaFold. But this is a couple of years ago technology now at this point. And so when you know, and I think everybody's all excited about it, you know, chatbots and that kind of thing. But that's not where the really interesting scientific outcomes are going to come from. So are there some specific projects that you're looking at that are starting to tackle some of the problems that you think are important? You know, are there some interesting projects that people could go and take a look at?
Yeah, there's one. So I started another nonprofit called the Align Foundation a couple years ago, which serves this function of sort of going out to scientists and trying to figure out what are the valuable problems that would change people's scientific everyday like accelerate their work, that maybe are actually possible to solve with AI. And as one example, Align is hosting a data collection effort to gather large-scale data on which organisms can grow in which cultivation conditions. So Align is trying to find 1,000 phylogenetically diverse microbes and then gather data on how well they grow in 1,000 diverse cultivation conditions. And the reason this is cool is not just because that data set, I want it so that I can use it, but also because it is the format of data that might actually allow us to build predictive models for predicting, say, which microbes would grow on Mars. So all this work I'm doing in the wet lab to like get lots of microbes and test them out, I think it is possible that we could create AI algorithms that I just give it the genome of a microbe and it gives me, with some confidence, a prediction of whether or not it would be able to tolerate conditions that have perchlorate and salt and so on.
Yeah, right? And I know there's a lot of research that's being done in just, say, novel drug discovery that, you know, once you feed in all of the attributes of different chemicals into these models, then they can help you narrow down the search space and go, well, you know, look in this area for potential new antibiotics. And I think I can imagine it's the same thing that they say, well, look into this genetic portions for these kinds of resistances that you're looking for and really narrow down. And then you can bring on board technologies like CRISPR and so on, where you can go, okay, fine, I've got the chunk of DNA. Let me see if I can put this onto a bacteria and see what happens. And so it speeds up this process.
Yeah, I think there's, as you say, there are many glimmers of hope of like things that are starting to work. And these are all threads that I'm excited for people to pull on. So just to expand on the microbe example. So this project that the Align Foundation is trying to spin up is based on a paper called Bacter AI. It's a system that was developed by Paul Jensen's lab at University of Michigan. It was published a couple years ago. And what it does is they figured out like an active learning technique for taking a organism and allowing the computer every day to pick another 10 experiments to run every day for a week. And it does that in a smart way so that by the end of the week, it super efficiently navigated the huge combinatorial space of all the things you could possibly put in your cultivation conditions. It ends up being just like very efficient at coming to robust conclusions, even with very few experiments, right? So that there's like already things that are like starting to work. And I think the friction that still exists is that as a discipline, life science has lagged behind other areas of science in its ability to do high throughput experiments with standardized metadata and actually share the data and have it be reproducible. And, you know, moving atoms around in the universe when those atoms are living is just inherently even more complicated than doing a physics experiment, and that much harder to do nice controls and get good data quality. But that's the challenge. That's the challenge AI has presented us with, which is that we have a new computational paradigm. If we want to make the best use of it, we have to get our act together in terms of gathering data.
Yeah. Well, Erica, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me. Good luck with your attempts to terraform Mars. I look forward to a green Mars.
Awesome. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Dr. De Benedictis. Now, I'm going to give you some final thoughts, but first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Andrew Gross, Barely Griffin, Brian Bodie, Caredwin, Chuck Hawkins, Commander Baylock, Cy Nelson, David Giltina, David Matz, Dustin Cable, Evan Pearl, Greg Feely, Hans Schultz, Hudson Moore, Jay Graves, James Clark, Jeremy Mattern, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Marcel Smits, Michael Purcell, Modso, Paul Robach, Ren Kaidu, Robeck, Sean Sargent, Stephen Fowler-Munley, Thomas Ilskadron, Vlad Shiplin, and Wolfgang Klotz, who support us at the Master of the Universe level. And all our patrons, all your support means the universe to us. Like many of you, I've always been really excited about this idea by terraforming Mars. When I first read Red Mars, Blue Mars, Green Mars by Kim Stanley Robinson, I was all in. Yes, let's terraform Mars right away. But as I have been doing this job now for decades and have become older and wiser, there are other ethical thoughts that we have to consider about whether or not, you know, if there is life on Mars, will we sort of make it so that we're unable to study it? And so we have to approach these kinds of ideas very carefully. But the long timescales of carrying off something like this gives us the time to consider the ethical consequences and make a good decision, something that, you know, you can have a lot of stakeholders that are being part of this. If we actually did start warming up Mars, then maybe this would give a chance for all of the existing life that is on Mars that went into hibernation when the temperatures got too cold, it could start to wake up, and that would actually be a tremendous opportunity to study whatever indigenous life there is on Mars. So it is such a complex subject, and it's something that we really need to think about and need to consider. And then when you know, obviously people are going to be saying in the comments, I'm ready for it. Like, why terraform Mars when we can't even fix Earth? Well, by learning to change another planet, considering the kinds of factors that go into making a planet habitable and livable, we will also learn a lot of lessons will help us protect the planet that we live on, that this kind of scientific research will be useful even if we never go to Mars. So there's a lot to think about, but it sure does fulfill one of those sort of science fiction dreams that you have, that we've got from reading all those books and playing all those video games and playing all those board games like terraforming Mars. All right, I hope you enjoyed the interview, and we'll see you next time.